You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry, Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM. I'm your host, David Gilmore, and today I'm welcoming Michael Schmelzer, a poet of renown in the Northwest from some prizes he has won. A book finalist called Blood Song of fairly recent vintage by the Two Sylvias Press. Correct. And a previous chapbook, Elegy, Elk River. And so welcome, Michael, to Sound Poetry.
My father was in the Navy for 20 years, so and that's how he met my mother, and I have a lot of conflicted feelings about military, let's say. I am very much a pacifist. I believe that war is just awful, but like my father being on the Navy base and seeing my father in uniform and all that, there's still a great swell of love that I have for people in uniform, because it's just something that it is a sacrifice and it is a hard life that military families go through. And my father is very stoic, but also I know underneath that is just such a gentle person. I know a lot of where I come from and how I see things is from both my parents, though they don't necessarily show it all the time, that it does come out here and there. They're just a very different generation and were taught a certain way of behavior, but they never enforced any sort of boundaries like that for me, which is, I think, where I came from. They allowed me to be me, and here I am.
Very lucky in that.
Yes.
But then you were able to speak for and against at the same time, because you weren't very good at debate.
Exactly. I can always... You can always see the other side.
Reconcile.
If you humanize the other side, it's so much harder to villainize them. That can be a flaw, but I think it ultimately will save us from destroying each other.
Yeah, war is an aspect of civilization that we haven't quite dealt with fully. Mm-hmm. It still goes on, and we can't eradicate it. And yet it's one of the things, perhaps, that we really have to eliminate if people are going to live and be able to move as migrants from one place to another.
Yeah.
Even the barriers and boundaries are elements of enmity, it seems. Not so much friendship.
I'll read this piece. I am always upset. I was trying to find a solution to war and harm and all that stuff. And just,
it's a good one on that.
Yeah. I think a lot of it was in response to my own not childhood. I think I was such a sensitive kid, and I'm still a very sensitive person, but with that comes so many hurts, and a long time I tried to deny that and be someone else. So I think a lot of this poem comes from that, wanting to be something else. In the Great War, I become cake. Out of desperation, I believed in God exactly four times, and each desperation moves with me like a sentimentality, a piece of trash my daughter once held, and hence I can't let go. May I speak of the beloved beetle I painted prismatic? It opened itself like a red gift and dazzled a message in multiple wings, but it never lifted. We can kill, especially with our clumsy love. Friends, how do we move with the grace of kind words? Or like forgiveness we don't deserve, but receive? My prayer is to be more ear and less tongue. The more I witness, the less I believe I'm built for this world. Growing up, I willed myself into a sword. Then, as I aged, a shield. I am old enough now not to need war. With each clang, I hear the heart quiet a little more. In the Great War, I become cake. I can't withstand anything, not even a little rain. I have one job, I feed the hungry and refuse to ask which side they slaughter for.
That's quite a profound statement of your pacifism. You become cake. That will throw many a reader the first time. But you have the softness, the vulnerability in it throughout that makes great sense of that. And of course, people are so machete-minded.
Yeah, they would have no problem. And I've come to sort of accept my role in that, is that I don't want to be a soldier and I don't want to be any part of it. I just kind of want to take myself out of that in a lot of ways. I think the idea that we have to participate in some kind of cruelty in order for our side to win, I think is a trap. And I see a lot of that. The whole new manuscript that I've written that'll be coming out is my little elevator speech about it, is that it's about war and war crimes and the literal and metaphorical idea of softness. And so I just wanted to juxtapose those two things. I think the only response to cruelty and dehumanization is a flooding of tenderness or gentleness and humanization. So I've been just really focusing on that to a point. I just don't see any other way. And I wish there was some kind of grand solution, and I wish there was a better and more efficient solution, but I just think it takes time, and I think it takes a very slow evolution of people to start actually realizing that just because you're on the righteous cause doesn't mean you're doing righteous things.
Yes, that's right. We are troubled about how to go about being better actors in the world that perpetuate the finer aesthetics, the softness, the kindness, and so forth. And it's sometimes very, very difficult in families because of the way they can be annoying to one another, especially bound up in a home-bound situation such as we've been in.
Yep.
But there are times now that we're all going to be let out of the hive, and perhaps we can spread some dandelion seeds, blow them with the fox's breath, very tender, puff. Now, you've chosen a little mythology or a folklore for one of your verses that has some of the hardness, the starkness, the warring of it, of life. The execution of Goemon?
Yes, correct. And so I had written this piece. I was really interested in the idea that what happens when you look closely at a side that is historically very much on the side of right. Specifically, I was looking at World War II. And because I'm half Japanese, I'm half white, half American. And so there are these two conflicting sides that were literally engaged in war with each other. And Japan historically was not anywhere near being righteous in that war. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the U.S. did commit some crimes against Japanese people, and the way they used the dehumanizing propaganda where Japanese people were depicted as rats. I mean, literal dehumanization in these posters in the war effort. And so you look at how each side played out, and it's easy to look back and say, oh, like, thank goodness this happened or that happened, but there are lessons to be learned there. So I just was looking at a lot of that when I wrote this. The execution of Goemon. And as a note, Ishikawa Goemon was a Japanese outlaw who stole gold and valuables to give to the poor, and he and his young son were publicly executed after an assassination attempt on Toyotomi Hideyoshi. The outlaw holds his young son above his head to save the boy from boiling alive. Or the outlaw holds his young son above his head, then plunges him in the boiling oil. In all versions, we need the father to show us how to die. with arms uplifted as if in praise, as if he could raise his child to paradise. A riddle. Which version of this thief shows the most mercy? Which version of the sun the heaviest? A riddle. Who died first? The father who killed his son swiftly, or the father who died knowing his boy was next? In the Great War, a soldier's teeth were battered from his mouth for their gold crowns. In this way, he became monk-like, a vow of poverty smashed into his face. Because he died experiencing such cruelty, he must have also known enlightenment, a moment of such clarity when relief was all that was left, and all time became now, and all taste was blood and rice and soup his mother made when he was sick and knew it would be dinner time because no more teeth or gold or sons or fathers, no value in beating a dying man in a wrecked field where oil and fire and men bellow, armed to the teeth, willing to gnash the bone of a father for the sake of their sons. Dear deities of the great war, emissaries of the final stillness, before you belch up bombs and bodies, I ask you, break my jaw with the butt of your rifles, so I may know which words are most precious. When I speak again, it will be as one who knows peace, like an ache of healing, like an arc of a bullet that misses its target. When my father found the courage to hold an immeasurable tenderness in his hands, it was then he finally held his granddaughter up. That part about the father is true. I was the first one to have a child in my family, so as a first grandkid, and for a little while he refused to hold her. It was just, she was too delicate. He was afraid he was something was going to happen, and he, after a little bit, finally did it. So there's that moment where I think that's kind of human nature, that we're afraid of ruining something or afraid of making something worse. And I think that holds us back from not just loving very openly, but also helping.
Yes, I do enjoy the way you have found some of those extremely sensitive moments that are full of a fearful fragility. The way the children, well, the way you described the painting of the beetle, which may have been a live beetle that you painted the wings and which couldn't maneuver after that, which is not so much to embellish the life of a creature, but to still it and take something away from it. But you have, in the efforts of children to pet animals. Mm-hmm. I remember our son accidentally killed a rabbit that we had as a pet for a couple of years, and the rabbit simply jumped and he caught it, and it pencil spined us. That was one of the most tragic evenings of our lives when the kids were little, you know, that he was aware of what he'd done. And so there is this aspect of life that you never forget that when you've experienced a moment of that sort of stillness, that fragility, that the wonderful tenderness of a moment.
Yeah, and there's something about that makes you realize like how, and I don't know why that it makes me feel that way, but I just think that there's a certain importance to fragility that needs to be preserved, and it's, and you see it in children too, just their kind of innocence that they grow up in. And you, I think as a parent, you always try to protect that. You want them to remain sort of protected in this little bubble. And you know that's just not possible, but you try.
Yeah. Well, what you did in that poem too, though, you brought some of the savagery and brutality of warring and torture at the beginning, and brought that up into the courage to find tenderness, which is very interesting movement in the poem. When you say a poem moves, I mean, this one is in sections too, because we've got a break. Do you do a poem like this one in completion, do you work in parts and find the way to join them up or to find these contrasts?
I usually work like in completion. I don't think this needed much arranging per se. I have all these kind of swirling ideas in my head, and that's kind of how I process. I process very visually at times, but I can almost see kind of these complicated, sometimes contradictory ideas and visions that I want to just mash together.
Right.
And this one was fairly organic, and it came about, I think, relatively quick compared to how I usually write. There was just that juxtaposition of like cruelty and torture, and also, like I said, how to respond to that. And the natural inclination is to return it. When you were hurt, you want to hurt back. And I think that impulse can get us very much into trouble, whether it's a relationship with a spouse or with your child or with a parent. I mean, the impulse to hurt in return is extremely powerful. But I think, like I said, I just keep coming back to thinking that tenderness and loving in return is the only way forward.
Yeah. The enlightenment that you speak about, that experiencing such cruelty, he must have known enlightenment. Mm-hmm. So there is some sort of virtue even in the scenes of warring and the denouement of the war with the father and son being sacrificed or actually assassinated, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, of such clarity, a moment of such clarity when relief was all that was left and all time became now, the enlightenment of realizing that there is this still moment of nowness that will never be relived. All taste was blood and rice and soup his mother made. This one really does have a wonderful change as it goes forth. And the music of it, I really like musicality of your verse. There's a lot of B sounds, the beating and so on, but the belching of bombs and bodies, that is very profound, I think, in it towards the end. And yet we come to a safe landing. Mm-hmm.
I hope it does.
In matters of the spiritual, which, of course, that enlightenment idea in that one has something very mysterious about it. You wonder, why does it happen in situations of such horror? The nature of the visceral that you do incorporate so well. Blood Song is really quite a hard book for a lot of people. I read many to my wife, and she says, "Oh, that's going to be hard for a lot of people to continue reading." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Yeah, that's right. Poetry should be hard."
It is. It can be a bit heavy, I understand, in it. So.
Well, in terms of the religious, you've got at least one poem in which you use the word God, but really the divine or the God is not involved in much of your work. But do you believe in the four times that desperation brought some sort of divine image to mind? That is when a divine actually enters?
Yeah, I have a very complicated relationship. My relationship with poetry and my relationship with the idea of God or some kind of higher being is pretty much the same. It's something that I have very little control over, but I do have very much believe in something greater than humanity. I've had several experiences that make me think, okay, there has to be something greater than just humans out there, because we're okay, but I would really love there to be something greater than us. It's something that's great for me to think about, and it guides me personally. It's nothing that I expect anyone else to be guided by per se. It's just something that I think is a mystery, and I love the mystery of it. And to me, it doesn't necessarily matter if there is a God or not. It's what we do with the life we have now. I don't think there's a certain set of rules.
So we now go to a work on prosperity, which has music throughout.
Once again, I love the grocery store stuff. That is because I've been taking my parents out a lot. So
right.
A lot of my visuals is grocery stores and opulence or whatnot. So prosperity. The human tongue, like the tail of a scorpion. Every word first formed in the venom gland of our brain. The story about the scorpion killing itself when surrounded by flames, it isn't true. It's just dying, despite the theatrics. Was fire the first instrument of torture, or was water? What we can do with the simplest elements is enough to keep me awake. Sleep, too, when taken away, is another form of punishment. And what about language, well-wrought and sadistic? We now define this as a violence. No, not define it, we make it violence. Not too long ago, we used music unbearably, tortured our enemies with song. Then we invented a way to drown them without drowning them. I am at the grocery store buying cotton candy grapes, water in bottles, a Honeycrisp apple. I am stumped by the number of body washes. We're blessed with the pleasure of meandering up and down aisles while listening to the heartsick songs of our youth, even though we're safely in love. We forget the failures that matter most. We call those moments prosperity. We speak the boring platitudes of peace in order to keep moving. And even during war, we share pleasantries as carefully as shaking hands with a sword.
So you have obviously listened to a lot of the classic old rock while shopping, which I know it doesn't often come to mind in writing a poem, but it adds something again of the absurdity. What is it that they think that these old songs of the 50s and 60s are going to make people at ease while they shop?
I don't know, but it is funny though, and it's so sad in a way, because I'll hear songs that were new to me come on the grocery store and I'm like, hey, is this old? I'm like, that's not right. This is new.
Well, when you came to America, I came to America in 58, and I remember very much what sort of music was on the radio, you know, the pop music. And I also came to a country western area of the country. But do you remember what sort of music was that entertained you when you first came as a young kid?
Yeah. So I know a lot of the popular stuff was kind of the hair metal, Guns N' Roses, and that kind of crew. I didn't really listen to that a lot. I listened to a lot of pop music. And then later on, more of like Depeche Mode, and more what would be considered kind of goth, or the, I'm not even sure if it's like what that is, but very moody stuff I ended up getting into as a kid. And I don't know why I was more drawn to that. I think there was a different kind of musicality and a different kind of depth to the lyrics that really attracted me even back then. I listened to a lot of old records that my dad had. He had a lot of old records. So I had the Beatles, White Album, Doors, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan. He was very much loved music and listened to a lot of that. So I think that was probably my first real foray into poetry, was listening to all the lyrics and listening to the music and how they made things rhyme and sound. And there's a beauty to that that I really enjoyed back then. And I wouldn't have been able to articulate it in the same way, but it was definitely one of the first experiences of what I would say is the lyric or poetry.
Did you come awake to the music of our time largely through the reminiscing through your father's music, or was the metal and that other stuff informative in some way of the place you'd come to?
Once I began to explore music on my own that wasn't just things on the radio that I could find, I think it was very, very much informed my writing in a lot of ways and what I thought about and my concerns as far as, I mean, all the, it's kind of funny, and whenever I talk to high school students about poetry, I say the same thing, is that all the concerns you have now as a teenager are basically the same things we're talking about as adults. We just articulate them in a very different way, but it is still heartbreak, and it is still why do bad things happen, and all of those things that, you know, what is your identity, who are you, and are you just the things that you do, or if you, you know, all these things that teenagers are dealing with even nowadays are just the things that we think about as adults.
So this idea of defining, we make it violence. Mm-hmm. That is talking about language well wrought. Mm-hmm. And sadistic. Mm-hmm. Is this a reference back to the way language is used through the social media, or do you find that sometimes you're putting rather sadistic ideas into your poetry that is in some way a bit torturous for the reader to come to grips with?
Yeah.
I know we all do this in poetry. I mean, you can't help, because your imagination is not going to actually sit well in everybody else's decoding box, right?
No, I definitely have been thinking more about language. I mean, in terms of, like, I pay attention to a lot of, like, social justice dialogue, and there's a lot of the needing to speak out or needing to protest and having all these different forms of expression, let's say, and the term silence is violence. Like, if you're not saying something actively, then you are participating in a type of, you know, violence. And so a lot of that I find on an intellectual level very interesting, is that can words be violence? Can silence be violence in a very real way? And I think about different things, like monks who take a vow of silence or whatnot. Is that, can that be a form of violence then, in the most very holy, spiritual, sacred way of silence? And what can that all mean? So I've just been really thinking about what that whole phrasing means. And I part of it is, like, we can do such damage with our words.
Yes. How to listen so well that singeing of hair is a kind of music that works into the aesthetic of the olfactory.
Yeah.
That was, I enjoyed that. That turn. That was very, very impressive. And I thought long about that, from the audio, the auditory, to the olfactory. Yeah. Okay, now we go on to they eat dog, you know.
I'll preface this one by saying that a lot of this has to do with when I first came to America, hearing a bunch of various racist jokes about Chinese people or Japanese people. And I mentioned it in one of an essay I wrote, that it was almost told in a way that was very innocent. It was very much just we're sharing something. And it wasn't actively cruel. It was just such a strange, passive, innocent cruelty to tell these jokes. But my dad had mentioned before, being in the Philippines, or a station in the Philippines at one point that people would basically fish for dogs that were starving, and so they would fish for dogs to eat. And so I have all these memories and things that I've been kind of wrestling with when I wrote this. They eat dog, you know. Yes, in the Great War, we massacred dogs. Afterward, we ate them roasted over fires. Wag your tongues all you want. We ate our enemies and their families too. We ate the bamboo forests, delicious as arrows of asparagus, the mountains with teeth like sticks of dynamite, the shrines and the names of all our dead digested in our stomachs. Limb by limb, the nations we swallowed. Judge us, you and your kin who have never been this hungry. I heard the joke about the Asian restaurant serving canine, the one about naming their kids after the clang of utensils thrown down the stairs. It's only funny to Americans who haven't watched a starving father use a chunk of flesh to fish for dogs who were also starving. It's only funny if you don't come home empty-handed, chewing your child's name like a piece of fat. Stab our meat with a fork. Call it hunting. Put our chopsticks in your hair and call it fashion. We welcome you into our homes. Opulent obeisance, we've cooked the most elaborate meal you can't pronounce. One you never had to call sweetly to slaughter.
Different worlds. My father-in-law lived in Germany during the Nazi uprising, and they had a cat for Sunday dinner. They called them roof rabbits. And he remembered being asked what it was that was roasted on the table, and he didn't quite know how to say it in a culinary manner that would make it still presentable. But yeah, other worlds. We in Britain had rationing. We had horse meat rather than beef. My mother got very good at things like tongue and brain and heart and you name it. Yeah, so I grew up enjoying a lot of the worst parts, at least in a butcher's shop in America. But in other worlds, they still have tastes for things that are abominable in other cultures' culinary repertoire.
Yeah.
But yours is definitely a dissertation on the need to eat, the hunger that drives one to a cannibalism, and that there's no guilt in that.
You know, this is what I can give now, and I'm exhausted, and I'm tired, and I'm sad, but there's also still so much joy. So.
Well, I'm not exhausted myself, but I am quite overjoyed that you came all the way from Seattle. Was it Seattle?
Yeah.
To join us, and this has been a real pleasure, Michael. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been Sound Poetry. I'm your host, David Gilmore, Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM.